Thank you all again for joining us today to discuss Professor Thompson's proposal in his article, the Federal Act to Promote Integrated Water Management, which is CDMA, a useful model. Professor Thompson is the Robert E. Paradise Professor of Natural Resources Law at Stanford Law School, and the Perry L. McCarty Director and Senior Fellow at Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment. Professor Thompson is the Chairman of the Board of the Resources Legacy Fund, as well as the Resources Legacy Fund Foundation, California Trustee for the Nature Conservancy, and a board member of both the American Farmland Trust and the Sherman Institute. Previously served as member of the Science Advisory Board for the EPA, and is a partner at Lenovan and Myers in Los Angeles. Professor Thompson clerked for Chief Justice Rehnquist of the U.S. Supreme Court, and Joseph T. Speed of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Professor Thompson will be joining us via teleconference today to return to Central America, and we have a great panel of commenters today: Brad Campbell, Michael Connor, and Adam Schiff. Brad Campbell is a nationally recognized environmental leader who currently has his own law firm, Bradley & Campbell LLC, where he focuses on issues involving the environment, energy, and entrepreneurship and science. Mr. Campbell has served as commissioner of the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection, and prior to his service at DEP, served as regional administrator of the EPA Mid-Atlantic region, and before that as an associate director at the White House Council on Environmental Reform. He is currently a public scholar at Monmouth University's Urban Coast Institute, and has also been a visiting professor at the University of North Carolina Law School. Mr. Campbell clerked for the Honorable Carl McGowan of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, and Thomas A. Flannery of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, after graduating from the University of Chicago Law School. Next, we have Commissioner Michael Connor. Michael Connor has been commissioner of the U.S. Department of the Interior Bureau of Reclamation since 2009. He has nearly two decades of experience in the public sector, including having served as counsel to the U.S. Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, and before that in the Department of the Interior as Director of the Secretary's Indian Water Rights Office. Before joining the Secretary's office, he was employed with the Interior Solicitor's Office in Washington, D.C., and in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He began his interior career in the Solicitor's Honors Program after graduating from the University of Colorado. And finally, rounding out our panel is Adam Schemp, joining us from the Environmental Law Institute. Mr. Schemp is a staff attorney and director of the Western Water Program at ELI, where he's been since 2007. He leads the Institute's work on water rights, allocation, and use. And his major areas of interest are water resource management, specifically matching the incentives from water law and policy with conservation and sustainability objectives. Before joining ELI, Mr. Schemp clerked in the legal department of the Denver Water Board at the Native American Rights Center. Mr. Schemp is a graduate of the University of Virginia. I'd like to thank all of our commenters today, and I'm here to go to Professor Thompson.
Good afternoon, or maybe it's still good morning for you. My name is Buzz Thompson. I'm very sorry that I'm not able to actually participate in this conference. As hopefully somebody has told you, I'm right now in Central America on work, and I just was not able to arrange it to be back in time. But I do hope I'll be able to answer questions that you might have by telephone at the end of this presentation and the panel's comments. Because I'm not able to actually be there, I thought I would choose a nice location for the shooting of this video. So I'm here at Stanford's Jasper Ridge Reserve, near San Francisco Creek, because what we're going to be talking about in this panel is water and water management in the United States. My paper has two basic propositions. The first of the propositions is that in order to solve the major challenges that we face we have to have much more integrated water management than we have now. The second of those propositions is that borrowing from the model of the coastal zone management, the federal government can play an incredibly important role in both encouraging and enabling that greater integration of water management.
I want to start out by just giving you a sense of some of the types of fragmentation that plague the water field at the moment.
there's two basic types of fragmentation, substantive fragmentation and geographical fragmentation. I'll give you three examples of substantive fragmentation. The first is the fragmentation between groundwater and surface water. Groundwater and surface water are the same resource. They're hydrologically interconnected. But for years, our law and many of our institutions have treated groundwater and surface water separately. In many states, we still don't integrate surface water and groundwater at a statewide level. When somebody pumps groundwater, that can impact the amount of surface water that's available. If we overdraft the groundwater aquifer, that can actually reduce the amount of water available for surface water usage. It can also rob groundwater-dependent ecosystems of the water that they need to support the wildlife that live in those habitats. And yet again, even though groundwater and surface water are hydrologically interconnected, legally they're frequently fragmented. A second example is the interconnection between land use and water supply. It's probably an obvious point that land use can impact the demand for water. As cities grow, they need more water. But also the way in which we permit cities and other areas to grow can impact the supply of water. The amount of impervious surfaces has actually grown faster than city population. And as those impervious surfaces have grown, they can have impacts on water supply. So there was a study, for example, in 2002, which found that as impervious surfaces have increased, the amount of groundwater recharge has decreased. That study found that the amount of impervious surfaces that have increased in Seattle has actually decreased groundwater recharge by enough to actually service over 500,000 people on a yearly basis. The third example of substantive fragmentation is in our urban areas, the fragmentation between the water suppliers on the one hand and the wastewater disposers on the other. We have a real opportunity in our urban areas of taking wastewater, recycling it, and then reutilizing it for water supply. But unfortunately, in many urban areas, the water suppliers are different entities than the wastewater disposers, which makes it just that much more difficult to begin to use that wastewater as a source of water supply. Compounding this problem of supplement fragmentation is geographic fragmentation. You can take a watershed, like the small watershed that provides water for the San Francisco Creek, and you will frequently find scores of different local agencies responsible for one or another aspect of water management. Just for the small watershed here for San Francisco Creek, I count 9 different local agencies. In the Santa Ana watershed in Southern California, there are about 100 different local agencies. And this gets compounded over and over again throughout the United States. To get a sense of what happens when you combine the substantive fragmentation and the geographic fragmentation, all you have to do is to take a look at a major watershed such as the San Francisco Bay Delta, which is an area which, as you probably know, has seen great controversy over the last 20 or 30 years. This is an area which faces many environmental challenges. Most of the focus has been on trying to protect the listed species in the Delta. And the solution that people have focused on is trying to reduce water supplies to Southern California. But the truth of the matter is the Delta suffers not only from water diversion, but it also suffers from contaminated flows of water. It suffers from overfishing in the Pacific Ocean, which impacts the fish in the Delta. It suffers from invasive species, and it suffers from habitat preservation. All of those various issues are handled by different agencies, and frequently you have agencies at the federal level, the state level, the regional level, and the local level with authority over various aspects of those problems. So to try to solve the entire Delta, you have to figure out a way of bringing all of those various entities together to manage it. So when I first started looking at the idea of integrated water management, one of the things that struck me was that the fragmentation that we have in the water field today looks very much like the fragmentation that we had in coastal management in the 1960s. In 1969, the Stratton Commission, a federal commission that Lyndon Johnson had formed,
issued a report that said that we were never going to be managing our coasts effectively unless we had the state manage them on an integrated basis. There were simply too many agencies responsible for managing our coasts, and local agencies frequently did not have the authority needed to actually manage the coasts on an effective basis. So in response to this criticism, Congress passed the Coastal Zone Management Act. Coastal Zone Management Act was unlike many other pieces of environmental legislation in the early 1970s. First thing was that the federal government didn't decide it was going to manage the coast. Second of all, it didn't even demand that the state manage their coast. Instead, it did two things. First of all, it encouraged the state to manage the coast on an integrated basis, and it did that by providing a variety of incentives, including matching funds and also technical support. The second thing it did was it helped enable state integrated management of the coast by agreeing that if the state came up with coastal management plans, that the federal government would act consistent with those plans. That was necessary for state coastal management plans, because if the federal government didn't comply with them, then there really wouldn't be integrated coastal plans. And second of all, it was another way of encouraging states to come up with these coastal management plans, because they knew that if they did, the federal government would need to comply with them. And whether it's because of that enabling aspect of the Coastal Zone Management Act or the incentives, or simply because the Coastal Zone Management Act put the attention on the importance of having statewide coastal management plans, the 35 states that have coasts in the United States all actually ultimately adopted coastal plans in response to the Coastal Zone Management Plan, although one of them, Alaska, actually backed out of its plan in 2011. So just like the federal government had strong reasons for passing the Coastal Zone Management Act, there are also a variety of reasons why the federal government not only can play a useful role here, but actually should be playing an important role. First of all, the federal government has a lot of different agencies working in the water field. And so unless the federal government is part of this integrated management effort, then integrated management is not going to work. Second of all, the federal government has a direct interest in making sure that we have effective state management. The federal government has Federal Reserve water rights and a variety of activities that the federal government is involved in. For example, the production of energy are areas that the federal government needs water for. So the federal government has a reason why it should want better management, which, as I mentioned earlier, requires more integration than we've had in the past. Third of all, to the degree that a state does not have effective management, it can affect its neighbors. 95% of all the water in the United States actually derives from interstate rivers or interstate aquifers. And so if one state is not managed effectively, it can affect its neighboring state. In addition to that, if one state runs out of water for any reason, it frequently looks to its neighbors for some additional water to help bolster its water needs. And third of all, because virtually all business requires water, effective management of water is also very important for interstate commerce. So borrowing then from the Coastal Zone Management Act, recognizing the importance of integrated management, my paper suggests that Congress might want to consider a Sustainable Water Integrated Management Act, what I've called SWIM, because of course all acts need a good acronym. So SWIM, just like the Coastal Zone Management Act, would not require states to engage in integrated water management. It certainly would not actually have the federal government develop integrated water management. Instead, it would both enable and encourage the states to engage in more integrated water management. So take the enabling part of it first. Just like in the coastal area, there are a lot of federal agencies involved in water management. And so if integrated water management is actually to be effective, then the federal government has to be part of it. So under SWIM,
the states would be required in developing integrated water management plans to involve the federal government. Once an integrated water management plan is developed for a state, it would be reviewed by a federal agency, most likely the Department of the Interior, and if it met the various criteria of the Act, then all federal agencies would act consistently with that state plan. Because again, if the federal government isn't acting consistently with that, then we're not going to have truly integrated management. Second of all, SWIM would provide the states with a variety of incentives to encourage them to actually engage in integrated management. Integrated management can be complex, it can be costly, changes the status quo. All of that means that states will sometimes be reluctant to engage in integrated management. By providing incentives, Congress can actually encourage the states to engage in that management. And I think Congress has a variety of ways in which it can provide useful incentives. First incentive is funding. First, with budgetary concerns today, there's much less funding that might be available. But Congress could consider actually giving states that engage in integrated water management a priority in various types of conservation funding that's currently available to those states. Because we would agree that states engage in integrated water management, those states are more likely to actually achieve various other conservation goals. Second of all, as I mentioned a moment ago, the federal government would agree to act consistently with those state plans. For many states, that's going to be an important incentive. Third, the federal government could provide technical assistance to these states. Developing integrated plans can sometimes be technically difficult, and so those states that might not have the technical capabilities that the United States has, for example, through the U.S. Geological Service, could really benefit from that type of technical assistance. Fourth of all, many of the integrated plans might have elements of those plans for actually restoring, for example, part of a watershed. And so a fourth incentive would be an agreement that to the degree an integrated plan has a restoration project that requires federal approval, that there could be some type of expedited or simplified federal approval of those particular projects. So that's the most controversial incentive that Congress could provide, would be to delegate regulatory authority to the state. Actually, Congress already delegates regulatory authority in some areas to the state. But that delegation is incomplete. So Congress might consider adding a provision to SWIM that if an integrated state water management plan actually provided the functional equivalent of a federal regulatory protection, so the federal government would then delegate its authority to the state. So, for example, if you had an integrated state water plan that provided protections to endangered and threatened fish species, the federal government could think about delegating that federal authority under the Endangered Species Act to the state in recognition that that state plan is providing functional equivalent of what the Endangered Species Act would otherwise provide. That would be very attractive to many states, and it again would avoid duplication. Again, just to summarize, the basic proposition behind the paper is that if we want to manage creeks like the San Francisco Creek that you see in the background here more effectively in the future, we have to move towards more integrated water management in the United States. The federal government can play an important, in fact, I think a critical role in both enabling and encouraging that type of integrated management. And for the reasons I mentioned earlier, the federal government has reasons why it should want to play a major role in improving water management in the United States. I'm sorry that I wasn't able to be there in person with you today. I hope you've at least enjoyed seeing the creek in the background during my presentation. And I hope in a few moments that I'll be able to answer your questions by telephone. Thank you very much.
Well, all I can say is I'm very glad that Nature reported that, because despite numerous ways in which we were going to be able to communicate with him today, none of them are working at this moment. So we're going to go ahead and start with the comments. Is Mike, can you start the call?
Sure. Okay, I thought I would start off and caveat to my presentation because I think it's appropriate, first of all. I appreciate Eli asking me to comment on the article, and in particular having forums for me that I didn't submit any written comments earlier on, so I will try and make up for that now. But the disclaimer I want to give you is basically, let me start my timer here, that as alluded to, I spent 8 years working in clean energy and natural resources basically, I spent 8 years developing, analyzing, justifying, defending, or attacking legislation. So it's not inherent in my DNA now to agree with anybody's idea of what legislation should look like. But also, to add to that, I spent the last 4 years running the Bureau of Reclamation and having to be accountable for my own gray ideas that got enacted into federal legislation, which now I have responsibility for implementing. And as I found out, some of my great ideas are a lot harder to put into play in practice in reality than they were in sitting in my office in the dirt in the office building there. So I'm also, I think, given that practical aspect of legislating, which I think can come through in my analysis of the proposal here, I'm also much more sensitive to the idea of the limited nature of financial resources available to the federal government and federal agencies, and even the difficulty even with good ideas of shifting priorities. In this climate, particularly that we're in today, where I came in, I might have had a little different perspective implementing the Recovery Act and having basically an additional year of appropriations to allocate and get out on the ground in a 1 year time period. Now that's been completely counterbalanced by reduced budgets and sequestration. And so that'll come through a little bit in the comments. I guess overall, I would say, and it probably goes without saying, given Professor Thompson's volumes of work in his presentation, it was a very, from my perspective, very well reasoned, very well written article. And a very objective analysis of even his own proposal on how to use DNA as a model to facilitate or have the federal government take an active role in trying to encourage states to move forward with integrated water resource management plan. I think I was amused when I read this on explaining back to California and some of the very issues that referencing. And it seemed every time I started writing in the margin, identifying an issue, like, what about this, what about this, and you know, in the next paragraph it was addressed. So I very much appreciated the balanced analysis. And I think at the end of the day, based on that balanced analysis, the pros and cons, even in putting proposal forward, and even with DNA, I think I came to a conclusion myself that there's probably maybe not better ways, but more realistic ways of trying to move forward and accomplishing the very large goals that the company identified. And so that's kind of where I come out at the conclusion. The fundamental premise that the federal government has a strong interest in facilitating good integrated water resource management, and the fact that there are poor water planning in one area can affect other areas and can affect even the larger national economy. This resonates very well. It's very accurate. This premise, I think, I completely and totally buy into. Moving forward and trying to act on that premise, I think the CDMA proposal has two. It would be a paradigm shift, to say the least. Now, in the article, we talked about a mandate for integrated water resources, and that's not what the CDMA does. And Professor Thompson very accurately notes the political difficulties that exist in the federal mandate with respect to water planning. And so, this is very realistic in this analysis from that standpoint. I don't think that's even a product of today's political environment here, where I think any legislation faces a monumental hurdle in trying to get enacted. I think boxes of activities. When I first when I started working with Jeff, you can say anything you want after you start your speech by saying, states have the primary responsibility for managing and allocating water resources. If you get that out in front, then you can say anything you want after that. Take comfort in the fact that you acknowledge that reality. And I think that's true. So I think any kind of federal overall planning in the area of water resources is always a good story to get over. And then I think the second paradigm shift is just the integrated water resource management. That's a tough task that you know. It's a very significant shift given all the jurisdictions, all the responsibilities, all the agencies at a local and state level to bring those agencies and different responsibilities together to do the very best. And so that in and of itself is a difficult aspect of the discussion. We dedicate the portion of the article, I think appropriately so, because integrated water resources management is a difficult concept. And it's very complicated, and there's not a lot of good models for how it's carried out. So I think we did the job of revisiting the overall goal of integrated water resource management, but you know, multiple agencies at the local, state, and federal level with different responsibilities, with different jurisdictions, working together in a defined region, area, or watershed to address a range of issues on a daily basis, a lot of resource challenges that we face, as you mentioned. So, and I think this is the difficult part. It's not just the planning exercise, it's the management implementation exercise. I think it's a very cut out. The article goes into examples of California has had in trying to implement integrated water resources management and the goals that they have against the water supply, groundwater management, ecosystem restoration, and water quality. So they have the fundamental criteria to be eligible under the state integrated regional water management concept. But I think this is once again where I think this analysis is very good and very objective. The jury's still out and whether California's been successful in actually managing water on an integrated basis. And there's a fair amount of criticism out there. I don't know, I believe in the integrated water management and are trying to make it a very real concept for which to move forward. But it's difficult, it's vague, and it's new. And so taking that, which is even being dealt with at the state level with mixed review, and the fact that other states haven't gotten into where California is, I think it makes it a couple of hurdles trying to work with legislators at the federal level to try and facilitate that model in all states. I completely also agree, though, that if you're going to go down that can be successful in achieving, particularly in the West, probably even each student because of the core of the community and their state responsibility. You can't do it effectively unless you have federal agencies advocate as part of the process. And so, from that standpoint, once again, from whatever model is used to go forward, I think you need to have participants constructively participate in the process. A couple of items, I just want to go through some of the specifics that he identified. If you are going to have a serious DNA type model, what would it look like? I think he addresses very well the critical aspects of any such legislation. Who would administer the programs? He concludes that the Department of the Interior would probably be best suited to do that. That would wholeheartedly occur, not from any objective analysis, but merely because the bureaucracy, and I guess the bureaucracy is like to take on more responsibilities and more power. In trying to set up how water would be managed at the state, probably a better use them to decide on how they would set up a particular watershed or region if they want to manage water according to, as opposed to trying to set that up by watershed. Water, so that's the right approach. integration aspect of it, and earlier in the article you note the problem of having district states the basis for doing integrated water resource management. We have planning in one state affecting another state. Your recommendation on heavily involved right now in two Supreme Court proceedings involving interstate conflict over water management in Texas and Oklahoma and in Texas and Mexico, two different proceedings. And then I think where you try and address that interstate issue, the proposal is to have DOI be responsible for trying to convene the parties and reach agreements that will mesh the different integrated water resource management regions. I think that's a very important policy issue, one of the first in the proposal of the central organization. The second aspect we talked about is and once again, I think very realistic approach on the limitations of federal funding. The second aspect, there's a lot of items we mentioned, but the second one I think I want to focus on, it's written about in three different ways. Federal consistency within the start of the state plan, and consistency to me then leads completely into the last item you mentioned, which was federal regulator. Can you have basically the states that take over that responsibility where they put together plans to see to concern? So I think once again that would be the most attractive aspect of any such legislation for certain states, particularly like California, who runs similar programs to better the federal level. California has their own legal teaching act, their own E-Plus Program Act, E-Plus. And so they're set up institutions to do this. There's a lot of resource issues for other states, so it may not be very attractive to put together a similar program. But second, I think it would be controversial from another standpoint for those who don't have that responsibility, those who are comfortable driving the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the fisheries being responsible for the major species issues, or the Corps of Engineers, and so on and so forth, experimenting. So I think it would be very controversial for those who believe that the federal government is checking the things that the states are responsible for, and that would be the organization controversial. So, from that standpoint, you mentioned the Bay Delta. We're working on a Bay Delta conservation plan right now. And a lot of the opponents, the state is very much invested in moving forward with this plan, developing new infrastructure and a very robust habitat conservation planning effort. So opponents of the office who come to the federal agencies in particular would say, you know, since your responsibility in the ESA or the NEPA, you've got control or checks what the state is doing in this area. So that's just an indication of whether it would be very controversial. So last point I want to make, and this is where I completely lose all credibility with you. Because while I endorse the overall goals and the reasoning behind the Petro Conference about, I don't believe necessarily that the CDMA model is a good way to go and that it is fully viable. So I'm going to suggest that maybe what the Bureau of Reclamation is doing under a legislation already enacted, the Secure Water Act, which is part of Public Law 111-11, maybe the way to go to find more realistic to get to those end goals. And I'd say we've all credibility because I had a very large hand in writing the Secure Water Act, and we're projecting in the bill that that's enacted in the end of the plan bill, 111-11, and then now, of course, we're trying to take that as a Bureau of Reclamation and bring that to life in an active planning process that we have. So the Secure Water Act basically it had a reclamation climate change program associated with this really different planning effort to assess supply-demand imbalance, the impact on certain resources because of that imbalance, and to develop adaptation strategies. So I think it links together a lot of those areas that Professor Thompson is trying to providing technical assistance in 50-50 cost share essentially on the study. We do it voluntarily. The state has to be supportive of that, other local agencies. And ultimately, what we're finding is the planning process, and we've got 17 of these basin studies ongoing right now. We've completed 3 of them large from the Colorado River Basin, where we have all 7 basin states and their cost share partners. We have a number of NGOs, Indian tribes, water districts participating in the effort. We completed the plan. It got a lot of press last year. And really, what we're working on right now is nobody wants the plan to go on the shelf. People want the plan to result in action, and action is what everybody buys into. And so that's the overall goal of the effort. We hope to replicate that in the other 16 basins that we're working in. So the bottom line is, I think more immediate is more politically viable. That's the approach that I think we can use. Federal government participate in this effort and help facilitate a more integrated water management approach. But I think the jury's still out and we'll be looking for that. Thanks.
Period of my work, I consider that the state role of the environmental protection needed absolutely strict scrutiny by the federal government and up to and including the state board. And then going to the point, right about the time that I became commissioner of the Jersey Department of Environmental Protection, I began to realize that the state had bodies for environmental protection. And it was odd that those two things occurred at the same time. It's also interesting in the context of the discussion about integration and the stove piping and fragmenting of programs that the solution proposed is to return to Congress, because it in some sense is the promise. So a lot of the fragmentation occurs because committee jurisdictions then get reflected in the scope of statutes, which then get reflected in the scope of agency work and mission. Which then is kind of reproduced by the counterparty agencies at the state level. So fragmentation in some sense originated here, and it gives me a sort of visceral skepticism that you necessarily place to solve it. Also, as someone who's been on both ends of the DPMA process, I have some skepticism about whether the DPMA is the best model, even as one reason for that is that it's really a problem not distinct to water resource management or the CPMA, but it's the problem of statutes that support to data management teams for multiple objectives. CPMA is the objectives that are permissive under that statute, although there is a strong environmental emphasis in even one of the earliest references to global warming, the objectives include economic objectives as well. And so when you're managing for multiple objectives, in some sense, you're not managing for any objective. Because the reviewers, the federal reviewers, are not going to be in a position to say, well, the state that prefers industrial consumptive uses over ecological uses, if they strike the balance that way, we're not going to second guess that, just as they won't second guess the state that strikes the balance the other way in favor of wilderness use and non-consumptive use. So there is a sense in which, absent standards, absent some mechanism of accountability, it's very difficult to see how federally encouraged integration costs is going to produce optimal or even better water resource management conditions. Because there's simply no standards justify an entirely new federal oversight scheme at a time when the resources available for environmental protection and natural resource management are declining. And even if the responsibility increases, you heard earlier today about how overwhelmed the community is with just the current burden of conservation and preservation of habitat. Creating a new structure for interior without a lot of new resources doesn't seem especially likely to be to generate better resource outcomes. The second point I would make is that there's really, in terms of the integration process, there's really a mismatch between federal and state competence. And probably the best argument for that is one that Professor Thompson made himself in the presentation he just gave, which is. And here I thought a similar answer to that.
I'm glad I got that.
As Professor Thompson said in his presentation, one of the central challenges of water resource management is planning, amount of impervious cover directly affects water supply, water quality, etc. And those challenges are increasing with the advent of climate change. And yet, the federal government is really probably the least able level of government to manage or review the management of land use controls. It's been the case under the CPNA. There was very little in the CPNA approval process, I would argue, that has changed the look of how our approach was developed since the inception of the CPNA. So I think there is, at that level, adding a federal role where in an area where the biggest issue and the biggest challenge apart from climate change is land use control, and currently federal agencies, at least when they're testifying before Congress, always disavow any interest in local land use control, I think that speaks to the limited value that has been created by this kind of issue. I also think it's important to note that there is among states a lot of very good integration going on without an overall statute like the one that's coming from. If you look at Florida Everglades, where the Interior is going to be a partner, we have a comprehensive plan put together that addresses everything from water supply in Miami to critical threatening invasive species habitat in the Everglades itself, to the water quality at the other end of the ecosystem in Florida Bay. That is a wonderful example of a communicative approach that brought together all the relevant agencies in a multi-jurisdictional way to produce, with some pain and lots of conflict along the way, a good result. I think the same is true of the data stage of the process at this point. You can witness in closer to my neck of the woods, you can witness the New York watershed. The entire watershed feeding New York City's water supply got together and essentially created a system of land use controls, other regulatory tools, both to protect New York City's water supply, but also to avoid billions of dollars in costs that would have been required by EPA if those protection of water quality higher in the watershed hadn't been put in place. And I think some of those examples, in my own state of New Jersey, we integrated water supply, with our water quality management, our stormwater rules, for example, stream buffer rules, which we established in our program for the anti-degradation provisions for clean water act. Elevated to address those I think those examples show that there's a lot more happening on integration at the state level than one would gather from Professor Thompson's article. I think another important aspect of that, of all of those examples, is that they are driven by the enforcement of federal measures. Commissioner Connor mentioned enforcement of the ESA and the rather than new federal resources being put into a new structure, which will create a new overlay of review and new procedure, I would rather see those same resources devoted, number one, to enforcing the federal mandate we have, which is often forced to and second, to providing the on the ground resources that are needed in these areas where immigration is happening in the form of a really comprehensive large-scale plan that addresses all of these issues. I would finally note that in terms of the areas where consistency, I have not found my experience consistency to be a great way of resolving disputes between states and organizations. Most for every job I've had has been a conflict with two people in Delaware. River, there are two states in the North Mississippi authorities to stop the project, and one state was pushing for the project. And that was not a great example of resolution. And the other example that Professor Thompson said, the Basin Commission also has not been very successful. I've known specifically the Delaware River Basin Commission, which you mentioned. Has been essentially tied in now for 2 years by the Institute of Hydraulic Fracturing, where they proposed a moratorium pending development regulations, and they've been split ever since with the federal member unwilling to break the tie, unable to decide how to go forward with the issues associated with hydraulic fracturing. So, I do agree with strongly with. I think it's if I was going to any new federal role, it would be in the way I have decided to position that is supporting those on demand efforts that are already in place and beginning to appear elsewhere. Third, speaking on to me, there is the most second problem is how do you more quickly resolve the conflicts that are not within states, but between states and between states and federal.
Okay, great. So just so you know, this is not Plan A, okay? We did have a phone system in here that was actually fine now to think about and not think about the discussion. That's probably the quote now. But I am now moving past and down to our last commenter, Adam Smith.
All right, well, I'm very honored to be here. For you today. I'm also very honored to be on this panel and be commenting on Professor Thompson's article. I will try to keep my comments very brief so that we can actually let him talk a little bit in real time and also open up for Q&A. I guess first off, I'll say I agree with Professor Thompson that water management needs to be better integrated. I think that most can work in this area would agree. Although, as we've seen today, there may not be quite as much agreement on necessarily how we would do that and the extent of the integration. Likewise, I believe that most folks in this area would agree that integrated water management requires the involvement of the federal government, as the economy is going to say. But again, how and to what extent will we be able to address? As is probably true for a lot of the issues that we discussed in these chambers, the devil will come. Professor Thompson's swim concept has promised, in my opinion, but the same factors that have made this issue so challenging today will also be a hurdle to that swim that we have to overcome. Law, economic policy, and executive practice. These factors differ quite substantially from those in the coastal context, and ultimately, in my opinion, undercut some of the strengths of those PCMA brings. Likely making it difficult for the people to accomplish anything that is stressed that is limited as to accomplish. As Professor Thompson noted, under the PCMA, the federal government does not demand state action, rather, it penalizes it. federal direction and review. NOAA decides whether a state's program adequately includes those elements, and it also decides whether to approve any proposed benefits to the program. So even with this fairly limited federal oversight, issues affecting environmental safety, the state would, in all likelihood, not be quite as inclined to participate in this program as it has been. The question then becomes whether the remaining portion of the act can compensate for this. Two key incentives that the conference removed are federal consistency and financial support under the CZMA. While the CZMA is quite arguably underfunded, the money that has been an attraction to state is quite small. In fiscal year 2010, Congress provided a total of $68.1 million for the CZMA grant program, and that's covering all participating states. It largely would take a great deal more money than that to incentivize and support changes, and to talk about how big these changes really would be in order to make it a success. And let alone the data collection and the sharing, as well as agencies and structures and kinds of ways in the way in which decisions are made. So starting to the water management is really costly, and we don't necessarily have a lot of money right now. There also is a matter of federal consistency, which has been covered at length so far. It's not quite the same in the freshwater context as it is in the state of energy. Under the CZMA, the state can force the policies that they think that the federal government relies on. Those are primarily focused on environment and human issues of the focus. We're talking about the water quality law, state use protection law, toxic dumping law, the federal government already follows a lot of these policies in the freshwater context. Much of the friction that has existed between federal and state authorities in the freshwater context actually stems from somewhat of the inverse. We're talking about federal environmental laws to state private activity and getting the species back causing the form of the community. Hence, Professor Thompson suggests offering something not in the CDA that would be streamlined federal permitting and delegation of federal regulatory authority. While these two incentives may begin to provide some of the consistency that the state actually desires as an engine project, they would need to be quite enticing to the state to compensate for the public's current lack of funding, adequate funding, federal contribution not really serving the same role in the business that has been in the not to mention the overarching concern about increased federal involvement in water quantity measures in order to make the individual swim as a practice of safety to the main element of the large percentage of savings in the whole. But I don't want these issues to overshadow what Professor Thompson has done here. We need innovation in law and government in order to keep water as a whole, and it will take cooperation and a little cross-cutting effort involved to all levels, local, state, federal, private entities, in order to shoot for the best of these developments to be successful in practice. The challenges are going to be the same regardless of the vehicles that we deploy in order to overcome them. How do we coordinate who leads when and how? And how do we pay for governance changes and data needed in order to actually be successful in implementing our agreement? To conclude, I think Professor Thompson has put a good foot forward, and I hope that this is a catalyst for further efforts in integrating water management and not just the water management.
Thank you. unfortunately, in the modern field, as I think everyone in the room realizes, there are no silver bullets. All we have is just a lot of broad shot. And I think integration in and of itself can help us get better results. One of the things that I've recently been studying is innovation amongst water organizations. And one of the things that we have discovered so far is that those organizations which are more integrated and take on a wider variety of water issues are generally much more innovative than those that are not. I think the comments today, and again, I'm sorry that I wasn't on the line for all of the comments, but I think they really raise three different questions. One question is whether or not a federal law or some type of federal intervention would be useful here. As Mr. Campbell points out, states already are acting in a variety of ways, and I didn't pretend to exactly list everything that the states are doing, but instead just provided a number of examples. I do want to say, though, that a lot of the examples that Mr. Campbell gave are unique, frequently one-offs. More importantly, they, I think, demonstrate in many cases the importance of federal nudging. So, for example, the New York watershed efforts really began with a nudge from the Safe Drinking Water Act, which forced New York to think about the trade-offs between protecting the watershed and water quality. As Mr. Campbell pointed out also, there are a variety of federal laws going to provide those nudges, but they provide those nudges in a very specific setting. And what I think is still useful and necessary is some type of a more comprehensive nudge that looks at this as a broad issue rather than an issue to just think about in particular settings. The other thing that I think a lot of the various examples demonstrate is, again, the importance of ensuring federal consistency. So I gather that one of the things that you've been talking about is the Bay Delta issues in California. And as a number of you know, the Delta Watershed Council that was established by the state of California to help in the resolution of the Bay Delta issue provides for the establishment of a Delta Plan. State agencies have to act consistently with that Delta Plan, but there is no requirement that federal agencies act consistently, nor is there a broad requirement that regulatory action be consistent. So, in fact, that plan is going to serve as a comprehensive plan for the Delta. There's some important elements missing. The second question, quickly, that I think the Baron's comments raised, is that assuming federal intervention is valuable, would an act like SWIM meet the bill? Would it actually provide a valuable way forward in this particular area? And I think there's just three things I want to emphasize with respect to the SWIM proposal. I think you could separate each of these out, deal with them in different ways, but I think they're important. The first is the federal nudge. And I think incentives, even if they're relatively small, if put into an act which focuses attention on a particular problem, can be quite valuable. The CPMA actually doesn't provide very much in the way of federal incentives, and yet it ultimately did focus attention on the importance of statewide plans. The second thing that I think is important is the federal consistency requirement. I don't think the CZMA has actually lived up to its promise of providing consistency, but I think that's more failure with the CZMA than it is in the overall concept of consistency. I mean, as Mr. Campbell pointed out, many federal agencies that don't directly deal with water, currently most of them don't integrate water resource management objectives into their mission. So having something comprehensive that would require federal agencies to think with states and how to address these problems would be valuable. And then the third thing that I think is important is some type of provision for encouraging states to address interstate water management, which again is something that Mr. Campbell emphasized in his comments. So I think the third question, just really quickly, is whether a law like SWIM is politically viable. I think that's obviously an open question. It's interesting to me that the comments I heard on the telephone, the earlier comments, focused a lot of attention on whether the states would be willing to support a law like SWIM. I actually think we're talking like SWIFT is indeed, it provides a strong consistency requirement, and if it even goes a step beyond that, that provides for further delegation of federal authority down to the state levels. So again, thank you very much for all the comments. I thought the discussion I heard and the comments were extremely valuable, and I just wish I had been there with all of you today.
Thanks, Buzz, and I'm just going to give Johanna a chance to make any additional remarks.
I basically agree with all the questions that we've been there's definitely value to a federal life. There's definitely a lot of use organic. And in terms of resources, I hadn't really thought about it quite this way before, but there is a sense in which Mr. Thompson's functional equivalency proposal or delegation proposal might answer the resource question in the sense that if you actually could produce a model in which in a state that has, in many cases, as stronger statutes than the federal government, if you really had the federal government backing out of those states, you'd be deploying resources elsewhere because they could declare a victory on water resource management. I think that would be an interesting way to address the resource question. I just don't know at this point that of our history of federalism, that there's going to be widespread support for federalism and backing out, especially when the successes that are in immigration were really driven at the state of federalism.
I think two comments that I would make go to the latter point on Thompson is whether federal agencies would be supportive of the model associated with the federal consistency requirement. Once again, I would just reiterate, I think that would be more than anything else the attractive part from some state's perspective. But in reading through the analysis, I think fundamentally it depends upon how much of our existing Oregon federal agencies' authority are effectively amended by this consistency requirement that would be in the CBA proposal. And I think that's a very complicated question. I could see some advantages, disadvantages from a formation perspective, but once again, I think when you go into particular issues like the Endangered Species Act, I think and the ability to assign that responsibility to state entities. From the state entities perspective, once again, I think the resource issue for some of the states, but I think those programs from the federal level would be very hard to be supportive of, and even if those agencies did see some value, their constituencies would be very negative. The second point about the Bay Delta issue, the way the Delta Stewardship Council responsibilities been set up in the Delta Plan, I absolutely agree with Professor Thompson that that's one of the fundamental shortcomings. If it doesn't, and it couldn't, mandate federal consistency with the plan, and that's really why the Bay Delta Conservation Plan, which is going to be one element of an overall Delta Plan, that's what we're really going to bring the federal agency ultimately, hopefully at the end of the day, to be in sync with where the state wants to take it. Federal law and state law.
Yeah, I'll just one real quick thought. With regard to the comment about state interest, I don't disagree. I think that there is possibility for the state to be interested in this sort of thing. I think a lot of it will come down, though, to the incentives, to delegation, what might be on the table, what might be offered, and then also how much federal oversight are we talking about, at what stage should the federal government be involved. What would be the equivalent of the nine elements of the climate change domain? How much direction would really be included within the domain? And telling the state what needs to be included in this program. If you get too strict with that, I think that there would be some pushback. If you get too loose, you may see even less real quality program than what we would see in the future.
I think what we should do, unless someone has a short pressing question, if the panel is willing to
that'll be closed out. First off, thank you so much for that. Recording of your conference. So again, thank you everybody for coming. And,